G'day and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and my guest on today's podcast is Andy Zaltzman. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. Thanks for downloading it and having a listen. Basically, we put out 12 episodes last year, and it wasn't a lot. One a month. We're trying to do them weekly this year. At the moment, we're doing them a couple a week. That's because the Melbourne International Comedy Festival is in town, and despite the fact that this is my busiest time of the year, it is also a time of the year where I can only get access to some of these people, so I've been trying to get as many of them in as possible. We're not going to get through all the episodes while the performers are in town doing their shows, and I hate that, particularly as a comedian. You know, you give up your time during the festival, and the thing that you've recorded doesn't come out when the festival's on in aid to buy tickets. So here's what I'm going to tell you. There is 5 days left of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. I have 5 shows left at Will Eagle. Tonight is sold out. Thursday night pretty much sold out already. So really only tickets to Friday, Saturday and Sunday. This is my favourite ever show that I've brought to the festival in the last 22 years. And this is your last chance to see it. So if you want to come and see it, 3 more shows, Friday, Saturday, Sunday are the ones that you can catch for that. But you got to get in quick because it's... I think it's all going to sell out, which is fantastic. Thank you to everybody for their support. Andy Zaltzman is also performing until the end of the festival. My next guest will be Deanne Smith. She is performing until the end of the festival. After that, I'm going to have Jason Byrne and Kitty Flanagan on the show. Both excellent, excellent interviews as well. The Deanne one I love, the Kitty one I love, the Jason one I loved. I think you're going to love them all. But they are all doing shows until the end of the festival, and some of them are doing shows around the rest of the country. So please check out their social medias. You will not hear the episodes until the festival is finished, but you might be able to catch them somewhere else. But if you're hearing this before the festival is finished, go and check out their shows because they've been generous enough to come along and record a podcast for me. If you like the podcast, the best way to help it keep going weekly, the reason it's coming out weekly is I now have Mike on board, podcast Mike, young, enthusiastic podcast Mike, who's been arranging all the interviews and, you know, coordinating everybody's schedules and making sure that all these interviews can be done and posted and all those sort of things. And, of course, Mike Howell, our US-based audio producer who weaves them all together. We pay those guys. And, of course, we pay James Fosdyke, who does the art, the individual art for every episode. So there's kind of, I guess, overheads of, you know, $400 or $500 an episode. And if you would like the podcast to continue, it is helpful for you to contribute to that. You don't have to, of course, but if you would like to, we have a Patreon page. It's called patreon.com/tofop, T-O-F-O-P. It's for all our podcasts under the Tofop banner. Tofop, Fofop, we'll also be Two Guys, One Cup, and anything else that Charlie and I might do under that sort of banner. But if you contribute there, you help keep all those podcasts going, and there'll be a heap of bonus content. And at some stage, we'll put in a Willosophy level of some kind with specific Willosophy content. But at the moment, we're just trying to get the podcast out weekly. So if you're enjoying that, if you're enjoying the little deluge of them, then if you could sign up to Patreon and give us some regular support, it just means that we know there's a little bit of money there to pay the Michaels every week on the podcast. All right, I'm not going to muck around too much. Enjoy this episode with Andy. It was a great pleasure to sit down with him. I'm such a fan of his political commentary. I'm such a fan of his cricket commentary. So we talk about both of those things, and we talk about a bunch of other interesting things in between. So here he is, the great man himself, Andy Zaltzman. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. This is how the podcast starts. Who are you?
I am Andy Zaltzman. I am a 43-year-old alleged comedian from London, currently in Melbourne for the comedy festival, with a new show that, on the evidence of the first night's performance last night, could be about 2.5 hours long if I did all the bits I was intending to do. And probably ought to be about 40 minutes long. So,
tell me that. I mean, because I love that, by the way. So is this the brand new show, as in first time you've done the brand new show?
Yes. It was the world premiere last night. Promising, I guess. It was,
How do you know? So I'm a person who oscillates between writing things down and often developing things on stage. And then at some stage writing it down so that I can then you know, make it better and, you know, work out what it's about. But this one show that I'm doing this time is about something real, and there were certain, you know, story beats in the story that I kind of had to tell at different times. So there was a lot of writing that went into it. And there was just a point where I just had no idea how long it was.
Yes.
You know, like I was like, I guess this is like, is this, it's meant to be 70 minutes. I think this is about 70 minutes. It turns out it was about 3.5 hours. So
Yeah, and bullet points are very hard to time, essentially. So I my process is probably quite similar to that. It's a mixture of, you know, stuff I've written word for word and stuff that I've, you know, will just have a note and have worked it out at gigs. And it, you know, will expand or contract just depending on audience response. And I don't really have an internal clock.
Is that how it's expanding and retracting? Like, you know, is it that thing of, I sometimes say this to people, which is like, come on the first night. That night you get to see what I thought the show was. You know, from then on we're essentially doing audience screenings night by night, and I'm giving myself network notes.
Yes. I guess, well, the audience, on the, I find the first couple of nights of a show is more of a focus group than an audience. Yeah, so it's, trial and error, stick pins and things and see which bits scream, I guess.
When you're out, we were just having a little brief conversation off air about, you know, the nature of, was I talking about the cricket in the show?
Yeah.
You know, we're both, you know, massive cricket fans, and I was complimenting you on your Unbelievable Ashes podcast that you did with Felicity Ward, who has been on this podcast previously.
Yeah.
But we were talking about the fact that it seems like a very... Yeah, it's like a Netflix series now. It's like a quaint HBO documentary about a certain more innocent time than the one we live in now.
Yes, I guess, yes, before sandpaper and after sandpaper, it seems to be the history of cricket now.
Certainly the history of cricket in Australia.
Yeah. It was a strange... I mean, the Ashes was kind of oddly disappointing on many levels, particularly as an England fan. I mean, the cricket wasn't that good, and England got rightly thrashed. So it was a bit of a challenge doing a comedy series through that when there wasn't have quite the visceral drama of the last time England were ritually humiliated here. But yeah, the I found the ball tampering story as a cricket fan, you know, quite obviously a bit quite upsetting, a bit depressing. But the sort of political and commercial reaction to it was an absolute Vesuvius of hypocrisy. And so I've built a bit in the show around that, and the moral boundaries that we set for cricket in particular that are just flatly ignored in politics and business.
It interests me though, Andy, and maybe I'm getting this wrong, but I think that the fact that cricket is held to a higher standard than, you know, politics and these sort of things. I mean, you're a person who has, you know, made comedy about politics, but a lot of the time, you know, you don't feel as let down by a politician lying to you as you do to, you know, cricketers
yes.
you know, behaving in this
well,
way.
Well, this is one of
I mean, the reaction has been more, but also I do feel more let down by the cricketers because I have higher expectations of them than I do our politicians.
Yes, and I guess, I mean, part of that, I mean, it's one of the reasons people love sport is, you know, it is that escape from the hideous realities of reality. So, and also you think, you know, sport is basically just pretend. So you ought to be able to construct a moral universe within that because it doesn't really matter. And so when that is fractured, then, yeah, people do feel more let down than in the sort of murky world of politics.
When I've spoken to people about my love of sport, and particularly cricket, I think is the one that, you know, comes to mind in this, is that, you know, it is that sense of that life itself is unexplainable.
Yeah.
So we have chosen something that, you know, is a microcosm of life, but we've given it a set of rules and values within which there's still levels of interpretation and weirdness and quirkiness so that it does indeed reflect, you know, this broader planet, but it's got these constrictions in place that we obey, and we, you know, it's manageable.
Yes. Well, I guess in some ways it is almost like the sort of ultimate kind of TV box set that's been going on since, well, in international cricket since 1877. So, yes, it is, I guess, a sort of constantly evolving, self-contained, alternate universe, almost.
I think one of the things that's interesting to me about cricket, and I'd love your opinion on this, is, you know, my friend Justin Hamilton often describes it as physical chess. And if you really want to understand cricket, you know, like so many games move so quickly that you don't have time to, you know, introduce this element of, you know, the mind games between the teams, which is, you know, a lot of, you know, the idea of, you know, those famous things of like when, you know, Daryl Cullinan used to come out to bat and they'd throw the ball to Shane Warne and it was already, you knew what was happening before it happened.
Yeah.
That's the mental part of the game, you know,
yes.
The bit where it's as much about playing your opponent as you would in a chess match than actually just playing the game itself. And I think that's why this propensity for these things to become more than what they are, you know, outside the boundaries of the game itself, come from that is actually part of the game itself.
Yes, the sort of stewing time, I guess, that you have, I guess, as a player. I mean, within international cricket, you know, Daryl Cullen, and I think, you know, Shane Warne, and the whole of England from that single ball in 1993 took 15 years to get over it, and only got over it when he retired. Right. So there's just that, those elongated narratives that you get. And I think that's why I can't take to 2020 for all its excitement and its skill, because it just doesn't have that time for endless reflection and the idea that, you know, players can stew on something for days within a game and weeks within a series and years within a career.
Do you have a philosophy towards something? That's the loose premise of this podcast, is that if you have a particular, and it doesn't have to be, I mean, you know, a philosophy, a thought, a mantra, a, you know, ideal by which you, you know, pursue something in your life. Is there something that fits into that category?
I'm not sure there's a full Zaltzmanic philosophy that's been yet that I've yet fully discovered within myself. I guess in terms of a sort of formal philosophy, I think I'm essentially a stoic, and I did a radio series in Britain last year about looking at ancient philosophies and trying to sort of live my life according to their teachings, and ancient Roman Stoicism sort of accidentally fitted into my general attitude towards life. So I guess not getting
let's pause on that for a second, because surprisingly, you're actually not the first person who's put that forward on this podcast. So.
Well, it's probably quite good for, well, comedians, I guess. You need to
The last person who said it was a brilliant Australian journalist by the name of Mark Colvin, who passed last year, I think. But he was a brilliant, well-respected ABC, hosted the flagship ABC radio news program like every day for, you know, 20 years. Probably the most trusted journalist in the country. And I had him on the podcast, and he also, described, what he got from the Stoics and that, you know, way of approaching life. What was it about that appealed to you? What was it that you said, this is something that I respond to?
I think it's the fact that it has a combination of you being sort of in control of your actions and responsible for your actions, but at the same time accepting, you know, when things, you know, being able to cope when things go badly and sort of accepting that as part of life rather than necessarily something to fight against or rail against. So it's, I guess, accepting that, you know, there are, you know, things that you can't control, but also that there are things that you can, and sort of knowing how to compartmentalise those various aspects of existence. I think it's a pretty healthy philosophy. General, particularly in a sort of increasingly hectic world where things can get, you know, just slightly overwhelming on a logistical basis, then I think Stoicism from, over 2,000 years ago has got some fairly basic lessons that don't change.
How many different ones did you do in the series?
Three. So I did Stoicism, Epicureanism and Cynicism. And there's a lot of overlap between them.
Sure.
Particularly Stoicism and Epicureanism. And obviously, you know, Stoicism sort of influenced the way that European culture and British culture evolved over hundreds of years, and influenced Christianity, which obviously suffused through Europe. So yeah, there's I guess an unbroken line going back to those sort of early thoughts and ways of life, right back to classical Greece, where these ideas emerged or were crystallized. So yeah, I think Stoicism was the one that most appealed.
Did you, it's interesting to me when you just actually do a little bit of further digging into something like that. Were there ways that you not only said this is, I recognize this kind of fits the person who I am, but were there things that you learnt in that journey of discovery that have kind of changed the person that you are since? Like when you do a project like that, is it about, I guess, going, I fit into this category? You've essentially done the equivalent of the, which Game of Thrones character am I on Facebook? Have you been data mined during this experiment?
I think it was more that, to be honest. It was a radio series, and radio comes with certain budgetary constraints. So it wasn't like I could devote myself to it for 3 months in a jungle or whatever. So, it was more, I think, confirming... ideas. One of the things I really liked about it, and just the whole ancient attitude towards philosophy in general, was how it was sort of a fairly active thing about the way you live your life rather than a rather sort of dry intellectual exercise. It was very practical, essentially almost handbooks for how to live and how to deal with the ups and downs of human existence.
Right, I think there is still a modern day thirst for that, right?
Yeah.
But it's just been filled with, self-help books and, pop psychology podcasts like this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess Stoicism is essentially self-help
fancy 300 self-help. BC. That's what you're saying. Yeah, exactly. Change the things you can change and accept the things you can't change.
That's basically it. And you've stretched that out for 200 pages, you can sell it as a book.
As a comedian, how does that influence your approach to comedy? Or how is that reflective in your approach to comedy?
Well, I guess it's... in comedy, stand-up, I see, it's quite similar in a lot of ways to sport, in that there's certain variables and your performance might vary or the reaction might vary. It's not, it's kind of sometimes hard to tell which is which. So I guess it helps you deal with, when shows go badly or not as well as you wanted, not to get, to be able to analyze that objectively. And when things go really well, you should be able to see that it doesn't necessarily mean you are a comic genius waiting to be discovered by the universe. So it's, I think, pretty healthy in dealing with the ups and downs of a job like standing up. Can I call it a job? It never feels like a job.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess, playing cricket for a living probably doesn't feel like a job until it feels like a job.
Yes.
And there are plenty of times doing stand-up where, you're doing the comedy equivalent of, a fifth day wicket in India.
Well, the
conditions are against you.
When I was starting out doing a lot of club gigs, when you do like a 20-minute set, and things would go variously well or badly. I tended to see gigs in terms of the opening session of a test match, you might, if it's gone really well, you'd be 120 for one or whatever. The ball's flying all over the place. Other times it'd be nipping around and you have to just, play it calm early on, maybe lose a couple of wickets and then rebuild. But then, of course, there's gigs when you're 43 for 8 at lunch or, England 27 for 9 in New Zealand. And
What about performative state? Steve Waugh, who you'll be familiar with, and I'm sure many of the people listening will be familiar with, was the former captain of the Australian cricket team and a real hero of mine, a man who... some people already know this story, Andy, sadly, because when you hear this story, you'll be like, you've already told people this story.
All right, okay.
He once came into the radio studio where we were interviewing him, and when he left, he'd left half a cup of tea and I drank the rest of his tea.
Right. That's a touching vignette. Did it imbue you with superpowers of for batting? Or
so, it's funny you should say that, Andy, because... I asked him something that I actually have taken into my when I think about doing comedy.
Right.
So I asked him a question about facing the great Western Indian bowlers. You know, you're facing these the fastest guys in the world bowling at speeds where it's incomprehensible over 22 yards that you can decide, I'm going to play a cover drive or a hook shot or whatever. And I just asked him that. And I said, you know, how do you know which shot to play? How can you tell in those conditions what to do? And he said, well, you know, you practice as much as you possibly can. You do it as much as you can. And then you hope in the moment that you get out of your own way and let your instincts kick in. So I'm interested to hear from you. Like, there's probably a point in a tour when you've been doing a show enough that you can do that. You can walk out on stage and just play.
Yes.
But early on when you're putting together a show, you're still in a different mode to that. Yes?
Yeah, I think it's almost the other way around for me a bit. Right. That when you have a... If you're doing a show that's sort of fairly tightly scripted and doesn't vary that much, then you sort of control it more. When there's improvisational elements, that to me is more like sport, where it's a mixture of preparation and kind of trained skills and reacting in the moment. So, and you know, I've never been a particularly improvisational stand-up, and I always tended to stick very closely to what I'd written. Then a few years ago, I started doing a show called Satirist for Hire, where people email me in advance with topics they want talked about, and then I take orders from the audience at the start of the show. And that's it's not full improvisation, but at the same time, it is reacting using kind of trained instincts, which I think is very similar to sport in general, but particularly batting. So with having been born, well, having grown up as an obsessive cricket fan, but trapped not in the body of an elite sports player, that was the closest I could get. It's almost like I managed to find, kind of accidentally, construct a cricket show, a stand-up show that was the closest I could get to recreating being a professional cricketer, which sadly nature prevented me from being.
What is your inspiration when you start putting together a show? Because I'm always interested in talking to someone at the start of a show. Because much like life, we reframe things through the experience that we're having right now,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
You know, so like 3 months from now or 6 months from now, if I asked you what your show was like at the start, you give me a very different answer probably to the answer that you're going to give me right now about
right.
where your show is. Like, where's your mind at? Is it an exciting thing to you? Is it a scary thing to you? Is it a thing that you're working on every day? Like, how does that work at the start of putting something together?
At the start of a run, a mixture of, excitement and panic, I guess. Slight elements of fear, inevitably. The human instinct not to embrace failure unless it's absolutely necessary. And I tend to work fairly tight to deadlines from doing the Bugle podcast. I'm sort of writing through the year, and then I will sometimes adapt things I've written in the Bugle, sometimes just take new ideas and then try and put them into a show. And I might have a vague idea of what I want the show to end as, sort of thematically, if I wanted to have an argument. And generally it just ends up being the funniest bits with a bit of structure plastered on top, rather roughly, but I'd love to be slightly more of a perfectionist than that, but it tends to sort of evolve and bits fall off rapidly and then come back, and I'm not sure I ever quite finish these things, but
I like that because I do think that there's something about the idea of comedy being complete that is an alien concept to me.
Mm.
Like, you know, even a bit where, I mean, every comedian can tell you a story of like, you know, where they've finally got some TV spot for some bit, or they've recorded their album, or they've done whatever. And then the next night they roll out that bit at a club and come up with like a better joke or a better
joke,
understand it better.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the idea that it's never quite done. Like, I mean, sometimes, you know, jokes feel a bit like, you know, that car your dad had in the garage that he just tinkered with other weekends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There didn't seem to be any grand objective that it would work at some stage, but he would just kind of fine-tune it a little.
Yeah, can't quite let it go.
Yeah.
I think it's probably quite a healthy attitude to... I mean, there's always things that can be improved. And I sometimes find on, you know, TV or radio shows on a recording day, if people aren't continually tinkering with the script right until the moment of broadcast, I get slightly suspicious, thinking you must have missed something. Right. There's always things that can be better. So, I get, you know, during the process of doing a run at a festival, I consciously try to put in a new joke every day, and which just helps to keep it fresh. If there's always a bit of the show that you're looking forward to, in the first week, there's a lot of tinkering to sort of get the show to some form of almost finishedness.
Right.
But then I just to keep adding bits to it. And what can be really frustrating is then if you come up with a great joke on the last day, right. You think, that's really annoying. But
At some stage, I'm going to get to the point where I'm going to collect everybody's names and numbers. And if the joke is good enough that I come out on the last day, I might not call them individually, but I might robocall them, election style. Just record that one bit and sort of make it available to them.
Yeah, yeah. That's a nice way of doing it.
So what is it that you are trying to achieve when you decide that you're going to, do a show? Like, what are the motivating factors that say to you, I'm going to, book the festival, I'm going to, have this run here, I'm going to, go off and do this aspect of what it is that I do?
I'm not sure I particularly have a sort of grand plan for these things. On a practical level, it's my job, if I may use that word I've discussed. And just as you say, with doing something creative like stand-up comedy, you want to keep creating and keep trying to find new ways of making people laugh and challenging yourself to do different things. And obviously there's a danger in stand-up. You sort of fall into things that work and get almost too settled in that. I think that probably happens to every comedian during their careers at some point. But I guess it's just that I just love doing it. And as stand-up is almost an addiction at times. And the process of starting with a blank sheet of paper and ending up with hopefully a show that can make people laugh for an hour and sometimes intermittently think as well. I just sort of love it in itself, really. I don't really have beyond that. I would say that I guess you want to sort of keep improving and developing as a comedian. I mean, doing people say with ask me to doing satirical comedy or topical comedy. Well, you're not going to change anything. You're not going to affect the world. But that's not really what it's about within live stand-up. Clearly, you're not going to affect great social change talking to a handful of people in a room during a festival, given that the nature of stand-up is such that those people generally already agree with you anyway. But there is a sense that there's also an element of training within that if you do that for a long time, if you then end up getting a break in television or whatever, then you've honed the skills to succeed. And John Oliver, my old partner on the Bugle, I think the reasons he's been so successful from the moment he went to America is because for 6-7 years before that, he'd been doing increasingly political stand-up in Britain. So he went there with sort of honed skills that could then be developed. And
skills, a reasonable base of expertise.
Yeah.
Some sense of history and patterns and those sort of things that help you differentiate, that world a little.
Yeah.
So then, if you are in that world, which you are, and you have chosen to be on purpose, what was it that drew you to... Because I loved what you said a minute ago, which was that thing, because I often when I don't always talk about politics, but, it can form a reasonable chunk of, my material from, time to time. And, the thing people always say is like, you're not going to change anything, are you? And I was like, oh, look, I was doing stuff about marriage equality for 18 years.
Yeah.
I'm fully aware of how little power I have to change anything, but so then why is it that you like exploring those things? What was it that made you think this is the area where I want to comedically play?
Well, I think it was that was the comedy that I'd always liked most before I started doing comedy
myself.
So tell me
about who that was. What was influencing you?
Well, I particularly love Chris Morris's stuff and Armando Iannucci's stuff in on television in Britain, particularly the Day to Day, and then Brass Eye. And I studied ancient Greek comedy at school and university as part of my degree, and that was deeply political. And I found it. I mean, it's quite odd to have like people often ask, "Who's your comedy hero?"
Yeah.
And essentially, my comedy hero is Aristophanes, who lived in sort of late 5th century BC. But he did this. He wrote these amazing comic plays that ranged from really acerbic political satire, and the political situation in Athens at the time was mostly on a war footing with Sparta, the neighbouring rival city state, over several decades. So there was a lot of war. There was democracy at the sort of hot, brief height of its early experiments, and so it ranged from political satire. Then there was a lot of literary parody, quite in-depth literary parody. But then you'd have slapstick puns and jokes about farts and sex. I mean, it's kind of total comedy, and it was performed in front of essentially the entire male population of Athens, ranging from the highly educated political elite to illiterate, uneducated working class. So it had to appeal to this vast spectrum, and it's an incredible sort of explosion of total comedy that it had to work on pretty much every level, and also as a visual spectacle as well.
I mean, it's amazing that you say that, because if you listen to The Bugle in particular, you can literally see that gamut. Going from high culture references to on the spot political satire to everyone who listens knows that there's never been a pun you've met that you have not enjoyed. But I'm the same.
Yeah.
Like, I am one of those people that often people will be like, yeah, we like the political stuff, but what was all that the knob joke or the horrible pun work? And I was like, no, this is all of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is, it all comes together as part of it. And that's interesting to me, like the love of it all. So you don't necessarily, you're not certainly one of those people who, has a snide attitude of, like, sometimes if someone's into one particular type of comedy, they look down their nose at other types of comedy. You have a broader palette or collection of things that...
Yeah, I think so. And with political comedy, there's a danger that it's not quite funny enough,
right?
Or not at all funny enough,
not at all funny.
Yeah, so I've always been conscious that you need to make it funny first,
right,
particularly in stand-up, because as you say, you're not attempting to bring down the government through live stand-up in a dingy room above a pub. So, it has to be funny. I mean, my audiences have not always agreed with that, and it's not. I've not always achieved it. I guess within political comedy, there's you can present things in you use absurdism, and there's obviously a lot of sort of parallel, the comedy of sort of parallel situations, and but there's different ways that you can take a political issue and make comedy about it that has some satirical content, but that it is fundamentally ridiculous and funny.
What I really enjoy about your comedy is that there often feels like there's stuff that like The Simpsons was at its best.
I'll put that on my poster.
Yeah. But there's jokes that you're not quite getting.
Right.
But they're not getting in the way of the jokes that you're getting. You're enjoying sometimes, a reference to something that the audience doesn't understand, or a joke about something that can be alienating to the person in the audience who doesn't understand that. Whereas, often with your shows, I think, well, I didn't quite get that one, or I didn't there's something about the way that it's put together that there's enough for every bit that you don't need to, you don't have to hit every beat of it. Does that make sense? Is that a weird thing for me to say?
No, I think that's, I'm always conscious that you never want to have a joke that excludes people who don't know about a certain topic. So, say if I'm doing a joke about cricket in a show, I'll try and do it Yeah, if it's not a specific cricket show or a cricket audience, in a way that it works for people who don't like or don't care about cricket, people whom we can only pity from the depths of our hearts.
I mean, I feel like they're the one group who do not deserve to be entertained by you.
Yeah, yeah, I should have a little entry form for a little quiz on the way in. Yeah, like I said, the you know, prime goal is to make people laugh, and then, you know, anything that gets in the way of that, whether it's a reference that's too obscure. I mean, you can use the most obscure reference, but if the you can make the joke still work with that.
If the framework of the joke is working, the actual wording at the end of it, it doesn't necessarily depend on that person knowing that reference to that philosopher or that, you know, period.
And also,
of time.
I guess in the particularly the age of the internet with Wikipedia, it's almost been the death of the smart ass because now everyone can look things up. And I think that's quite democratising. And
there's another element of your work, again, which then goes into this idea of the new world of the internet, where, I mean, we often hear, you know, it's the cliche of our times, you know, the age of misinformation. You know, you can find anything to support anything you believe, you know, fake news, alternative facts. But you're liberal with sprinkling amongst, you know, the real stuff, some other stuff too.
Yes.
Like playing with the form of what is true and what is not true.
Yes.
And what the audience's understanding of what is true and what is not true.
Yes. Well, generally, if I'm saying it, it's probably not true.
Yeah.
Rule for life. So, and again, there's a lot of comedy in things that could be true but aren't, and things that are true that shouldn't be. So, So I guess you're constantly sort of playing with,
but mixing those up.
Yeah,
I mean, you do.
Well, you want almost to create. I mean, a lot of comedy comes from, well, sort of a sense of confusion in a way. So if you can sort of create that and then tweak it, then it can be quite comedically.
Yeah,
fruitful.
I mean, there's that old. I mean, it's oversimplistic. There is no sort of rule to these things, but. Yeah, I think it was the Pythons who originally said it, and Eddie Izzard who quoted it a lot in interviews. But yeah, that idea of treating something serious, ridiculously, or treating something ridiculous seriously.
Yes,
a lot of it does fall into those areas.
Yes, and well, going back to Aristophanes, he had a in one of his plays, he said essentially, I can't remember the exact wording, and it would have been in Greek anyway. So I'd have had to. Check the translation. Even as a student,
a lot of it was very Russian.
But he said that the voice of the comedian was such that you could say things much more directly to people through comedy in a way that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily listen to politicians or more serious artists say it. And then Reginald D. Hunter said. Something almost exact, almost direct paraphrase of that. And he said, "You can't trust your." Again, I can't remember the exact one. But it was basically, you can't trust your politicians, your religious leaders, whatever. The only people you can believe are comedians, and the only reason you believe us is because you think we're bullshitting. So it's essentially the same philosophy, right. You know, from throughout the history of.
What do you
comedy.
Think then, when we now live in this world, and this has been happening for a long time, You know, they started talking about this, around the sort of Jon Stewart Daily Show era, where more, college kids were getting their news from, Tonight shows and the Daily Show than they were from, your major news outlets. And then suddenly, you did the Bugle with Jon, and he's had such great success with his show. But he's now a person who, and not of his courting, but, he's a person now who's become, almost this, respected voice of on a different level. I mean, not a comedian first and foremost, which I think is the secret to what he is able to do. He's able to talk about all these things that people ordinarily wouldn't have wanted to see on television, but with that comes this idea that somehow, I don't know, his words have more value, or this where do you feel, and I'm not really specifically talking about him either, just the idea of the comedian's voice being seen as more serious than that idea that it's ridiculous?
Well, I think it's the sense that a comedian has an independent voice. And I think in America, with the way the news media works, it is not always politically or commercially independent. I don't think I'm going out on a limb when I say that.
I mean,
so
I have to. Obviously, I don't normally edit the podcast, Andy.
So,
but
yeah. So the so if you come at something with independence as you know the comedic standpoint is, and ideally political comedy should attack all aspects of the political spectrum, then you almost sort of get an inverse authority. So I think that's you know where with John Stewart as you know, it was essentially news but not owned, if you see what I mean. So it had people turned to it for that, and also comedy is just a very you know, if you can package an unpleasant story in a way that's entertaining, that can be really quite powerful, I think. So I guess
what I wanted to ask you about off that is this idea of how do you feel about... It feels to me that you couldn't do what you do without some interest and perhaps at least at some stage, some love of news. But
yes.
How would you describe your relationship with news as news is now?
Right. That's an interesting question. I don't know. I find I'm increasingly intolerant of it. I found TV news often aggravating. I tend to get it more from reading stuff on the internet now, and I try to sort of read from as many different sources as possible. And it is kind of impossible to kind of get down to. In an ideal world, there would just be one source of news in the world, and it would all be fact. It would all be true, and you could rely on it. But clearly, that isn't. The last time they tried that, it was essentially the birth of organised religion, and that has had a checkered history at best. So,
all right, two edits. If you're going to start mouthing all these controversial opinions. Yeah.
And also, I find, you know, if I'll read something on, say, The Guardian, and I'll read something on the Daily Telegraph in Britain, and completely different views, and I just find myself getting increasingly confused about everything, which may be why I resort to sport and bullshit, which I guess are two branches of the same form of escaping.
But how do
reality.
You funnel like the state of the world through? Like, I get how you funnel it through your comedy,
yeah.
But you're also a man, you know.
Yes.
You're also like external to being a comedian or a podcaster
right.
or you know a writer, any of these things. You're also a man, you know.
Yes.
You're a person living in the world.
Yeah.
So how does? I mean, I the thing that I sometimes, like, my girlfriend does not watch the news, has never watched the news. And as a person like myself who will read, you know, I used to be a journalist and, like, you know, would read five or six newspapers, like, in the morning and then spend all day online consuming as much information as I possibly could. And I would always be like, how can you not, you know, read the news? And she goes, well, if anything really important happens, I'll find out about it. And I'm like, but how? And she goes, well, firstly, you'll tell me. And I was like, well, that is true. But, you know, is there can be a depressive nature to knowing too much that, like...
Yes, and...
Is that a valid thing to say?
Yeah, it is. And, well, I mean, particularly as... well, a lot of news inevitably focuses on bad things, whether it's kind of massive global... catastrophes and stories like Syria, but also just you know a lot of news. You know, there's people dying in unusual ways and random forms of human suffering, and so it can get it can be fairly overwhelming, I guess. But well, it's just sort of the nature of the world. And you sort of find ways of balancing it out through. The non-new stuff you consume, and like I say, that's where the escapisms of sport or Game of Thrones or computer games comes in, I guess. But
have you always been a person who has been able to find that balance, or is that something that you've developed?
I think I'm not sure I've entirely found. I think I'm gonna sort of go too far to the. I've always been obsessed with sport since my earliest conscious days, from about the age of six. I remember just being, and so I've always had that. I will, you know, always read the newspaper from the sports pages backwards, or well, I'll miss out the business bit in the middle. But it's the I guess that's how I dilute reality.
What is it that? So you still have the same passion for sport now that you did? Like, is it? Because I'm interested in that because what I've noticed is that I used to be, when I had time to fill in my life,
yeah,
you know, I had these great dreams of, you know, like pursuing all these different sports, not just as an athlete myself, but like later on when that turned out that wasn't going to be the case, you know, I had these great dreams in my 20s that I would go and watch Australia play test cricket in every country where they play test cricket. Right. And then I would, you know, go and visit this sporting event. And I would, you know, go through a season of the AFL, which is the sport I enjoy the most.
Yeah.
And I would go and see my team play every weekend, no matter where they were playing. You know, all these things. And then as life gets, you know, more busy and more complicated, you know, I've noticed that, it turns out basketball isn't as high on my agenda as I once thought that it was, for example. Like, yeah, what priority does sport still have in your life and what has kept you interested in it?
Well, I guess what's kept me interested in it is the, you know, it's just a sort of constant creation of drama and narrative. So, you know, there's a human obsession with narrative in many forms, from, you know, books and plays and films, and, you know, sport is the one that has always attracted me the most. In terms of my interest in sport, well, with cricket, I mean, that was, I guess, all a kind of lifelong obsession, and I started sort of writing about it, sort of, you know, I don't know, professionally is the wrong word, but in exchange for money. So it almost became part of my the job about, well, 10 years ago now. So that almost sort of quite rekindle my obsession with cricket, because it was always there, but it sort of meant that I spent more
gave
time.
Gave you an excuse, gave me an excuse to indulge your
just
obsession.
Spend days on the internet looking up statistics.
Yeah. You're talking to somebody who has an AFL football podcast. There is no reason to exist other than to, you know, make sure that I can watch a few extra games of football on the weekend.
But then I found I've got interested in sort of other sports for a little while, or we watch our local ice hockey team in London. I've become quite obsessed just with the extraordinary visual spectacle of ice hockey. I don't really understand the tactics, but it's a mixture of violence, speed, cunning. It's the sport that seems to require the widest range of skills to be good at. We just watch our local amateur ice hockey team who play in the second level.
Well, I love it because I have spent a bit of time living in LA, and we would go and watch the Kings.
Yeah.
Play, and I can't really watch it on the television, but like live
it's amazing.
Because a lot of them are like 6'8" for a start. Yeah. Secondly, they've got like hockey sticks. Thirdly, at some stages you can just punch each other, like, and they are all skating around like figure skaters with deadly weapons on their feet.
Yeah.
And that's the game.
Yeah.
And it never stops, and people just roll in and out. Oh, and there's a barrier that they can just smash each other into.
It's an extraordinary sport.
The combination of things that you need to know how to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's ridiculous and totally captain. But I don't really, you know, I don't follow the NHL, but I'd love watching it. I'd love. I got really into the Olympics and went to about 30 different things at the Olympics in London, and I just loved it. What I find with I've increasingly don't care who wins in sport, particularly on a national level. So with cricket, I grew up watching England in the 80s, and we lost two countries that essentially didn't exist. I'm sure they were made up countries. We lost to Lusitania at one point and in a test series, and so I just kind of learned to love cricket. And I find the jingoism and sort of overt patriotism of a lot of sports coverage, I don't know, it's been particularly prominent during the Commonwealth Games here in Australia. I find that slightly tiresome. And that,
you found the Australian coverage of the Commonwealth Games to be slightly jingoistic?
Yeah, I mean, I think in times gone by we would have slightly laughed at it in Britain, but if you watch the British coverage of the Olympics, it is essentially just the same. And fundamentally, I don't really care increasingly
also,
where.
I imagine, by the way, the Australian coverage of the Commonwealth Games, if the Commonwealth Games were on the moon and Australia was not doing well, it would still be a jingoistic coverage. But the fact that it is in Australia, it's coming off some bad sporting times for this country.
Yeah, yeah.
We're leaning in pretty hard to the fact that we won 28 gold medals in the swimming pool at the Commonwealth Games.
Yeah, yeah.
Turns out we've got a lot of renewed interest in lawn bowls now that we're a shot for the gold.
Yeah. Well, so I guess the legacy of the British Empire has... we won't say sorry, but we will give everyone a sports day.
as a a Brit coming to Australia to work, and you know, you've now done it, you know, a bit, and you've worked, you're alongside Australians as well. What this is certainly not one of those, you know, what's the difference between the, you know, British and Australian sense of humour questions. But I, what aspects of what you see in Australian comedy do you think are a byproduct of the environment we're in versus the environment that the British are in? Does that make sense to you?
I'm not sure. I think, I don't know if it's true, so there's less of a class obsession here, that, and I think that filters through the comedy. There's, I guess, there's, an honesty about...
There is class
about,
in Australia, but yeah. It is never spoken about.
Right.
It's certainly not that class, like, you know...
We're still obsessed with it in Britain in a way that I find baffling and tedious, but it still informs a lot of life. I'm not sure I've seen quite enough of...
Okay, well, I'm going to reframe the question and ask you something that perhaps maybe is a little... Why is it that you have worked with Australians? You know, you found yourself working with a bunch of Australians and working with them really well. Alice Fraser's been doing The Bugle a lot. You know, Felicity Ward, obviously, I mean, it makes sense. You were doing an Ashes podcast, you need an Australian, but, you know, you seem to have a very comfortable rapport with Australians.
Yes. I don't know if that's specifically because they're Australians or that it just happened to be that the ones I've... People I've worked with.
I may be turning into one of those. There's a very famous example of when Jerry Seinfeld first toured Australia, that he did a press conference as he got off the private plane at the airport. Right. And one of the questions he got asked was, what do you think of Australia? there is a little thing about Australia that I think is like, just tell, reframe all of your things through telling us about ourselves. But I think particularly when it comes to the British,
yes,
like that we do have that sort of attitude of that we still have a sense of, you know, like we're torn between wanting our dad's approval and wanting to fight our dad.
Yes. Know, I guess there's just the history of our two countries means that there is instantly a relationship between, you know, a British comedian and an Australian comedian, almost just through shared history, and particularly as a sports fan, that's maybe enhanced. I also think in comedy, an outsider's perspective is always comedically rich, and I mean, I think that's one of the reasons John's done so well in America, is he's able to look at America with an outsider's perspective. So if you have people from different countries, different hemispheres, then you sort of create that kind of dynamic of different perspectives. Anyway.
No, I like that. That's good. Because, I mean, you are a person who... I've always been interested in the way that you collaborate, you know. And particularly since John hasn't been doing the show, you know, you work with a whole... I hear you work constantly with a... Yeah, you know, quite a wide range of, you know, different people and perspectives. And it's always interesting to me to think... Why is it, you know, why this person? You know, like what was it about them that, you know, he sparks off so well, or that they bring to the table? But I think that outside perspective is probably pretty familiar. Like, you rarely have someone on the show who you would describe as a, you know, if we can't get Andy Zaltzman, we'll get an Andy Zaltzman type. You know, you rarely have an Andy Zaltzman type on. You know?
Yes, I'm not sure there's much of a market for Andy Zaltzman types.
What are the things about yourself? I mean, I guess at this stage as a performer that you would love to work on. I don't want to say improve necessarily, but like, you know, what are the aspects of who you are as like a, you know, a comedic performer that you feel like are the things that you want to be working on or playing around with?
Well,
challenging yourself with, or
logistically, I'd like to be better at meeting deadlines rather than smashing through them.
Right.
And, you know, that sense that... We talked about the sense of never quite finishing anything, and I think that's quite healthy, but at the same time, there's ways of doing that, and there's degrees of finishedness.
Yeah, sometimes things need to be finished.
Yeah, that perhaps... definitely I could improve my skills at meeting deadlines and, not procrastinating quite as much as... As I do. In terms of as a performer, I mean, there's always ways to improve. I'd like to be sort of learn to be more instinctive on stage, and that's a kind of gradual process that I think I've been working on for the sort of last 5 years in particular, and it's, you know, I think I'm getting better at it. But, you know, I don't think I've ever been particularly confident comedically. I don't know if any comedians are. A lot of it is a front. And, you know, people, you know, I'll say to my wife after a gig, I was really nervous during that gig, I wasn't sure what I was doing. She said, well, that didn't show. And you think, well, maybe that's just part of the veneer that you learn to project over the years.
Do you get inside your own head in those moments? I mean, the thing about a festival in particular is it always reminds me of... Because if you're just doing shows, and particularly if you're travelling from place to place and all those sort of things, one-nighters, two-nighters, there's a kind of reset in the process of going from one place to the other that kind of stops your mind. Yeah, you're in a new room. There's these factors that you have to kind of get used to. So you're in the show a bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, if you're 10 nights into a show in the same room, just by the very nature of it, your mind can wander.
Yes.
Not necessarily does, but... It has the capacity to do that. Are you the sort of performer that can get inside your own head while you're on stage?
Definitely, yes. I don't know, having only been me, I don't know if that's true of all comedians. But
no, please, Andy, speak for all comedians.
there's clearly moments in any show when you find yourself sort of thinking whilst talking. So you're, you know, delivering the routine but thinking about something else or analysing your performance. And we take it back to sport. You hear sports players talking about being in the zone where it becomes a sort of non-conscious process. And generally, you know, with comedy, you want to achieve that status of not thinking about what you're doing and it just sort of flowing out. But it's when it kind of comes and goes, doesn't it?
yes, Andy.
Yeah.
Yes, it does, sadly.
I keep turning it back to sport. But, yeah, you want to sort of get it into that zone. So during taking back to doing a long run at a festival, I think that's one of the reasons I try to keep putting new bits in so that you avoid that staleness. And I think, you know, even in a show that you've done 50 times, you can find ways of tweaking it, whether it's changing the order or putting a whole new chunk in even little tweaks of delivery within old routines can enliven something.
We should finish up soon, but there's a couple of questions I'd like to ask before we finish. Death, is it something that you are, you know, conscious of? Like, is it something that, informs you in some way? Do you have thoughts about what happens, you know, upon death?
Comedic death or actual human death?
Actual human death.
Actual human death. Yeah. I guess I think about it every now and again, it being slightly unavoidable. But I think that Stoicism has healthy attitudes towards death. You know, it's something that, it happens.
Yeah.
And, it seems kind of pointless to worry about it. Obviously,
there's things that you can worry about to influence when it may or may not happen.
Yes,
but in the broader scheme of that, it is going to happen.
What I think more about is elongated life.
Right.
that we as a kind of society and with the nature of medical science, we're living longer and longer, and we can't afford it. We've seen that economically across the world, and it is a major issue for humanity that we sort of seem to be asking, how can we live longer and longer, and not why are we bothering to do it? And, you know, what is the purpose? What are all these 100-year-olds going to be doing in 50 or 60 years? I think about that a lot. I think about, you know, my children. I have two children who are 11 and 9 now, and I sometimes find myself thinking, What is their generation's life going to be like when they're old, and, you know, there's a sort of aging world and not enough to do, and that worries me a lot. I find myself more worrying about being very old and particularly not having as long as I have access to enough televised sport, I think I'll be okay. But just on a global level, this seems to be a social time bomb that we are essentially ignoring. So I worry about that more than death.
Absolutely. I mean, I joke about it sometimes, but, you know, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have planned better. You know, like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I was talking to my doctor the other day about a bad back issue I had last year, and he just basically was saying to me, yeah, you're 44.
Yeah.
You're out of warranty. You're not original parts. You weren't meant to live this long and stand up this long. This is like all borrowed time from now on, basically, in the way that we were designed. And we now have this new class of people who are thinking about the concept of living forever. Yeah. You know, the ultra rich, you know, these people who have these stupid amounts of money now, they're doing a lot of research into what that next step of our, you know, world will be, where you don't have to die.
Yes.
Or see, that you can live on in some way, elongate your life in some way that is, you know, far beyond what we imagine right now.
That seems to be a problem that we do not need to solve. That, right. You know, we should be focusing more on, you know, people who are living having a better time, rather than people who are having a great time for hundreds of years longer.
Right.
So, it's hard to see how it's all going to... We all have, you know, kind of care crises around the world in Western countries, and, you know, state pensions came in when, you know, the life expectancy was 70 or something. The whole thing is just the maths doesn't work. And just imagining what is everyone going to be doing? I don't know. Unless we just have virtual reality virtual reality could be the savior of humanity. If you just a virtual reality headset for everyone in the world, and, you know, kids of my generation can put it on and, you know, have a virtual reality in which they own their own home and have a rewarding career, things like that.
Where it's not as hot outside as they
imagine. Yeah, yeah. To where they're not underwater. Yeah. And maybe that'll be the future of nursing homes in the future. Just loads of people sitting around with virtual reality headsets on, living as if they're young again.
I can imagine you being happy with the scenario of just, you know, catchy, like I think you'd be a bit like me, where you'd just be like, you know what, even if there's not something on, if I can access like the 1980s, you know, blah 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 series, I'm happy to give that another.
Yeah, that's
as long as now that I've got nothing else to do, if this is what I'm doing.
But also, I guess your memory fades, so you really like need just it. Play ball by ball test matches from the 1980s.
I mean, I am going to
stick me in a nursing home now.
I am going to be amazed by that Shane Warne ball of the century. Yeah. I'm like, wow, that spun right around his entire body.
Yeah,
I feel like this is really going to shatter them for at least 2 decades. What disappoints you the most about sport? Like, what is it that you see as sport's worst traits, the things that you don't enjoy?
We've talked about how it's supposed to be an escapism from reality. So when you have the same sort of excesses of sort of capitalism and inequality in sport, I find that kind of depressing. And we see it particularly in football, and I mean real football, not your crazy sleeveless version here. The massive concentration of wealth at the top, which
the
essentially
EPL, the English Premier League and all the European leagues, where essentially they're all paying, you know, the people who have the most money put together the best teams.
Yes, I find that, and you see, when you look at American sports, there's inbuilt structures to keep competition healthy. And I think, you know, they're trying that in 2020 cricket as well. Where, you know, cricket internationally has been, you know, there's been attempted power grabs by the richest countries, in the way that you think, well, it does not take much of a brain to realise that that is unhealthy for the game. The whole thing is dependent on relatively fair competition, or at least an illusion of fairness. So I find, you know, the way that money can sort of skew sport, in a way that, you know, it emerged from its amateur past, where there was sort of, you know, it was almost a level playing field because there wasn't that much money involved, and clearly it was never quite completely fair. But I think, you know, increasingly money has skewed sport and given too much of an advantage to the rich on an international level and within club sports. I worry about sport becoming seen too much as entertainment, it isn't. And it's often said, oh, you have to be entertaining. I think, well, that's not... It is, you know, it's drama rather than entertainment. I see this particularly as a cricket fan.
It doesn't all need to be
That
stuff. Like, you know,
the entertainment, it comes from, I guess, you know, competition and, you know, the sort of drama and the skills within it. It's I get annoyed when entertainment is sort of slapped on top of it, or seen as, you know, the purpose of sport. Which makes me sound like a grumpy old man, and I guess sporting.
I think
maybe,
you will perfectly lean into being a grumpy old man, Andy, and I don't think that you will regret a moment of looking back on times and telling people how they were much better than the times we're currently experiencing.
Yeah, they were much better in a time that never really existed.
Hey, Andy, thank you so much for doing the podcast. I really appreciate it. Hey, tell people about your show. What's it called? It's on at the Supper Room at the Melbourne Town Hall.
Yes, so it's on until the 22nd?
Until the end of the Melbourne of the Comedy Festival. And then you're doing some dates in Sydney?
Yes, so I'm doing, it's called Right Questions, Wrong Answers. So it's, again, it's looking at the sort of impossibility of knowing anything, basically, now, and understanding the completely baffling problems that are affecting us now and in the future. I've got two live bugles on the 15th, and Sunday the 15th and Sunday the 22nd. Got Alice Fraser doing the 15th, Tom Ballard on the 22nd, David O'Doherty's also doing the 15th, two nights in Sydney on the 23rd and 24th.
It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.